Morning.
Morning.
Waiting for one more person to get seated, okay? So this morning I'm going to talk about plasticity of the universe, the self, and the brain. My talk 2 weeks ago, I talked about the possibility for post-traumatic growth. And that was just before the election. Well, now, what an opportunity we all have for post-traumatic growth. And the reason we can have post-traumatic growth is because we have plasticity. So that's what I want to talk about. So I'll start off and just talk a little bit about cosmic plasticity, and then a little bit about plasticity of the self, and then a bunch of stuff on the brain. So cosmic plasticity, the plasticity of the universe. Life, the universe, it's a self-sustaining process. It's constantly changing, creating and recreating, as is human being. For thousands of years, this has just been happening, right? Every cell in our body is replaced every 7 years. Being fully present means being aware that we're always on the boundary of becoming something new. Boundaries are unstable, in case you hadn't noticed it. They're unpredictable, in case you hadn't noticed it. Countries are unstable, in case you hadn't noticed it. Unpredictable. Shorelines and weather fronts are getting more unstable and unpredictable, which has to do with something that I won't get into right now, but the instability and the unpredictability of countries, actually. Past and present. Present and future, you and not you, those boundaries are stable and unpredictable. So that's plasticity of the universe. The plasticity of the self. Trump won. And who's the you who was traumatized by that? Who's the you who's still out of sorts, who is still suffering? Is that the old you? Or is that a new you? Or is it something in between? Change always feels out of sorts. It always feels out of sorts. Unpredicted change always makes us feel out of sorts. Even good unpredicted change. That's the nature of life, right? So since the election, people are withdrawing. They're renouncing. People in my family renounced reading the New York Times every day for a while, renounced watching their favorite person, this is not me, Rachel Maddow on TV, renounced different things, listening to music instead of NPR, renouncing. So that's healthy. That's healthy. Withdrawing, renouncing is what we do in zazen, what we do in meditation. What I've been doing every morning for almost 50 years, or however you want to measure it, right? So we have our Rohatsu 7-day retreat coming up. Chance to do a lot of renouncing. Chance to just discover the plasticity and the resilience beyond the small self. That's always glomming on to some routine, always the same thoughts running through our brain. And when that happens, the connectivity of our neurons lose their plasticity. But in our meditation, we can learn to surf each wave, and see how the self changes with each wave. See how it changes. So we can become Nagas. Is Wanda here this morning? Wanda's not here. Well, anyway, I gave her a name. One of her Dharma names is Naga. Naga means serpent, right? Serpent. Serpent. We become Nagas. And in Buddhism, Nagas are cool. They're wonderful. Nagas have sometimes a single head, sometimes many heads. And they're malleable. They're plastic. They take many, many different shapes. You can't predict. And they seem to enjoy taking many shapes. They get off on it. They're not, oh, Trump won. They're just doing it, taking another shape. It doesn't mean that they're giving in. They're strong. They're not giving in to someone. I won't get into this. I don't want to get into this. I can't give my talk if I get into this. But you get what I'm talking about, right? So, supposedly, in Rahatsu Sesshin, which comes up the first week in December, we're celebrating Buddha's enlightenment. Buddha's opening up to this wonderful interdependence and interconnectedness that you feel in your heart of hearts. But to do that, he had to get protected by the Naga, the serpent, the cobra. This is, of course, mythology, but the mythology says the heavens darkened for 7 days while Buddha was sitting still, just as we do for 7 days here in Rahatsu. Well, some of you guys do it for 5 or 2 or 1. Do it for 1, that's fine. 1 is the same as 7 if you do it with your heart. It's exactly the same. Heavens darkened for 7 days. A heavy rainfall started. The mighty king of the serpents, Muchilanda, emerged from beneath the earth and protected the Buddha with his hood, the cobra hood. You can see pictures of this, right? When the storm stopped, the serpent king assumed his human form, bowed before the Buddha, and returned to his palace in joy. In joy. And so then we have Buddhist teachers being given the name Naga. The first prominent one is Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna, who is his whole teaching is about challenging any belief you get stuck on. Challenging it. So when we bring our full attention to the present, we begin to feel the permeability of the boundaries of our small self. We begin to see that these waves that are passing through us, these confusing, upsetting waves, are the ocean. Are the ocean. So in our Rahatsu, it's wonderful that someone is here to sign today. I'm just really happy to see you guys here. I used to work a lot with people who are deaf, and I tried to learn how to sign, but I totally failed. I think I have to wait now until my next lifetime, although I don't necessarily believe in reincarnation, so I don't know.
She said, not a problem.
Okay. Signing is such a demonstrative language. I always really enjoy, even though I can't understand it, I enjoy watching the way you guys communicate when you sign. Because it's got such physicality to it. Excuse me. So, starting a week from tonight, we're going to be celebrating Buddha's enlightenment and sitting together and walking together with the protection of the Naga so that we can shift our shape the way the Naga does and the way the universe does, the way everything does, continually shift our shape. And, of course, we renounce our TV. We renounce our internet. We renounce our busyness, our trying to accomplish, so that we can see and through the chattering mind. See it and see through it. We can't diss it. If we diss it, it just gets us more and more because it's what we are. We can see beyond our small self. The master said to the student, who was in Rahatsu on the I'm making this up. On the first day of Rahatsu, he came up for Doksan with the teacher, and he'd signed up for 7 days. And the student said, "This is too hard. I can't do this. I want to go home and see my mama." And the teacher said, "Why don't you leave?" The student started for the door. The teacher said, "Not that door." The monk turned and started for another door. The teacher said, "Not that door." Exasperated, the student started for the last door, but again the teacher said, "No, not that door." "But there are no other doors." "Yes, there are no other doors, so I guess you have to stay." So at that moment, according to this ancient Chinese story, which I just slightly revised, his mental noise stopped and his mind opened up like a clear blue sky. All the usual pathways to escape were closed down. And he experienced freedom. Freedom. Plasticity of the brain. Plasticity of the self. Plasticity of the universe. Wow! Wow! Historically, the brain was thought of as a machine with distinct local parts. There's the auditory center, the visual center, another area is responsible for our sense of smell, yet another for our sense of pain or pleasure. Each of these centers were believed to be discrete and localized. So if your visual center breaks down, there is no way around it. But modern research disputes that. The brain is polysensory. In his book, The Brain That Changes Itself, Norman Doidge wrote that it is common sense that we see with our eyes, we hear with our ears, taste with our tongues, smell with our noses, and feel with our skin. Who would challenge such facts? Then he goes on to challenge it himself with research that is opening our eyes to a world beyond boundaries. So the Heart Sutra that we chant every morning: no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. It's not saying that we have no eyes. Rather, our ability to see is not localized and contained within a single isolated sense organ. If eyes and ears are shut off, we discover that there exist other paths. Other paths. Synesthesia. Synesthesia, right? Synesthesia, seeing sounds and hearing colors. Here's Norman Doidge again. If the brain can reorganize itself, simple localization-ism cannot be a correct image of the brain. Consciousness works like a prism. It divides up experience in the same way a prism divides light. Not the true nature of light, though. So I'm going to cite four pieces of research here in 15 or 20 minutes. So we'll see if you can stay awake while I do that. Number one piece of research. Participants were blindfolded for 1 week in such a way that no light at all was allowed in. After just 1 week, they were able to distinguish barriers in their path by the auditory echoes. After just 1 week, they were able to distinguish barriers a second group was blindfolded in the same way to study the effect on their visual cortex. After only 4 days, the visual cortex was beginning to process the sense of touch. These studies and others like them suggest that we have to block out our most commonly used pathways to experience the non-locality of the senses. Well, that's what we do in meditation, isn't it? Isn't that what we're doing? We stop feeding the chattering mind so we can experience something beyond our usual small self. We open to a broader pathway. We can go beyond the local. Experiment number two. Dr. Baki Rita discovered that skin and its touch receptors can substitute for the retina. Dr. Baki Rita developed a device that enabled blind people to see by sitting in a chair with a tactile machine attached to their back and abdomen. Baki Rita and his co-workers have been placing touch-stimulating arrays on areas of people's skin, such as the back and the abdomen. The scientists used either electrodes or little buzzers to excite nerve endings of the skin in a pattern that corresponded to visual images. They found that after receiving training, blind people using these systems could recognize shapes and track motion. Some subjects could perceive the motion of a ball rolling down an inclined plane and bat at it as it rolled off the plane's edge. Others could carry out an assembly line task at an electronics plant. It required them to recognize glass tubes lacking solder and then to deposit some solder into these tubes. So, isn't this what our teachers and our teachers' teachers and our teachers' teachers' teachers were saying? Within one part of an organism is the entire organism. Within one part of life is all of life. Plasticity is openness. When we let go of the walls of the mind, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness, no path, no knowledge, no attainment. Anybody ever heard this before? Those of you who haven't heard it, you just come. It's our company song, actually. You want to be part of our company, come sing this song with us. No knowledge, no attainment. And as a result of this, the mind is without hindrance. That's what it says. That's what the company song says. The mind is without hindrance. And without hindrance, there is no fear. There is no fear. This isn't made up. This is true. True. Not caught by segregation. Not caught by divisiveness. Not caught by criticism. So a friend of mine who has had very bad hearing for his whole life and felt really out of it, recently got a cochlear implant, because cochlear implants are something new that, you know, my friend is almost my age. So he's like 68. So for like, and when did he get this? About 4 years ago. So like 64, he gets a cochlear implant. He's really never been able to hear. He's always been out of it. Because hearing aids, and I have two of them, only help so much. And his is an inner ear problem, so it wasn't helped by hearing aids very much. But the cochlear implant, we can be trained to adjust. It can be trained to adjust on the polysensory ability that we have. So my friend got his cochlear implant, and then afterwards he said, "I realized I wasn't missing that much." Here's another piece of research. Well, first of all, the tongue may be the second best place in the body for receiving visual information from the world and transmitting it to the brain. Did you know that? I read lots of stuff to give Dharma talks. Somebody was telling me that I should read more books. Everybody in my family reads books. I said, "I'm always reading books for Dharma talks, you guys." They didn't seem to think that counted, but for me it counts. Piece of research number three. Researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison are developing this tongue-stimulating system, which translates image detected by a camera into a pattern of electric pulses that trigger touch receptors. The scientists say that volunteers testing the prototype soon lose awareness of on-the-tongue sensations. They then perceive the stimulation as shapes and features in space. Their tongue becomes a surrogate eye. Tongue or skin stimulation, however, isn't the only way to circumvent blindness. Another scheme developed by a Dutch scientist converts images to what he calls soundscapes, which are piped to a blind person's ears. So there's a multiplicity of modes. What might our world look like if we not only saw its shapes and colors, but felt them, tasted them, and listened to them? Then we can all be knockus. We can all be knockus. But though the brain is plastic, right? It's fluid. Through brain noise, through habit, through addiction of many different types, the soft play-doh that is the brain texture hardens up. It hardens up. And that's why we meditate, right? That's why we meditate. When we develop a habit, the brain creates a path in itself in support of that habit. As we engage in the habit over and over again, the pathway becomes well-worn or stronger. The brain gets trained to do a particular behavior and experience a surge of pleasure and confidence from a routine. But it also locks in to behaviors that deteriorate the brain's plasticity. And this is actually addiction. This is addiction. This is what addiction is. It's very, very clear. Very, very clear. And there are all kinds of addictions. You guys know that. All kinds. And the biggest addiction of all, according to us Zen teachers, is the addiction to the little separate whining self. The little separate whatever self, right? And to the chattering mind that reinforces it. That's the biggest addiction. So in the 21st century, there are two fairly new addictions that have become very prominent, right? Computer porn and electronic games. Electronic games seem to come first, but now computer porn. Huge, huge, huge addictions. There must be all kinds of... I don't follow AA. I don't follow 12-step, but there must be all kinds of new 12-step programs now for people with porn addictions and computer game addictions. I imagine. Don't you think? There must be, because of... So, a 2009 study of school-age kids, 25% of them had an internet addiction. 25% of school-age kids. So I went down to Orlando to meet my grandsons, my French grandsons, and go to Disneyland. I spent a week down there. It was fun, but I don't recommend Disneyland. But it was fun. Anyway, we were staying at a beautiful resort, not on Disneyland, but out by a lake. And the resort had a ping pong table, swimming pools. What do the boys like to do? They like to swim. They like to play ping pong. They're learning to play pool. Everything. It has everything, arts and crafts. And then there's one video room. One little video room, and everything's free in the video room. It's all free. And Logan, my 7-year-old grandson, finds out about the video room. The boys love to be outdoors. They're outdoor kids. They love to do all kinds of sports. They're really sporty. But as soon as Logan found the video room, the outdoor activities paled in comparison with the immediate reinforcement that is... he could get in the video room. And Ethan found it, and then they cloistered themselves in it until their mama and grandpa came along and said, "No, boys, we'll give you an hour a day of that, but that's it." So our neural pathways so easily get addicted to something, and we have a potential to renounce that, and meditation is partly doing that. Doesn't not just sitting on a cushion, but in your life, opening up and not being caught by that one neural pathway that really hardens your brain, hardens your sense of not feeling part of a bigger world, right? So our plasticity is lost, and then it takes a lot to loosen it back up again. And in habituated behaviors, there's no room for Zen mind, beginner's mind. So new activities that we do, and I'm supposed to do a lot of new activities, according to my wife, who's read a lot of this literature, things I've never done before, because they will help me open up new neural pathways. So my teacher Suzuki, when he was in his 60s, I tell the story, he was, I don't know, maybe in his mid-60s, I picked him up at the airport in San Francisco when he'd been in Montana and visiting with one of his students on her ranch, and I said, did you have a good time? And he said, oh, yes. And I said, what did you do? He said, we rode horses. And I said, I didn't think you knew how to ride horses. And he said, no, I didn't know, but the horse knew. then a while later, he came down in some ridiculous-looking shorts and a sailor hat, going outside. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm going to play tennis with Betty." And I said to him, "I didn't think you knew how to play tennis." He said, "I don't know, but Betty knows." So, Zen mind, beginner's mind, big mind. You guys can all taste that. You can all move beyond this calcified stuff inside. One more study, okay? In the 80s and the 90s, some Italian neurophysiologists, Rizzolatti, Pellegrino, Fadiga, Fagassi, and Galles at the University of Parma, had the ventral premotor cortex of a macaw monkey hooked up with electrodes to study neurons specialized for the control of hand and mouth actions. Each time the monkey picked up a peanut to eat, the brain would signal click, click, click. One day, a researcher himself took a peanut and began to eat it as the monkey watched. The same sound, click, 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 resonated through the monitor, although the monkey hadn't moved an inch. The monkey's brain reacted identically on an observed action to when the action was physically done by the monkey herself. Repeated tests showed that an observed action in another can signal the same brain responses as first-hand physical action. And these are called mirror neurons. Mirror neurons. In any emotional engagement with situations, we have brain cells that can translate the actions of our own beyond either or, so that we can relax into many possibilities and many feelings and be more open to environmental stimuli. So the more our nervous system learns to recognize this big mind perspective, that's what my teacher used to use the term big mind, technically Vijnanavada in Yogacara Buddhism, beyond the limitation of time and space, the more it relaxes. And the more expansive areas of the more expansive the brain becomes, and these expanded areas begin to really thrive. Neurons multiply according to how often they are fired. If we don't use them, we lose them. We learn through resonating with the other, then we do it ourselves. The more often we walk these new pathways of the brain, the more easily the pathways open. The more we practice what I call bare awareness in our meditation and empathy, the more mirror neurons we have at our disposal. And the easier it becomes to disentangle and access to this deeper beyond. Deeper and yet beyond, right? So empathy, intimacy, inner being, interdependence. This definable separate self has cracked open. A physical peanut for one can be an experiential peanut for all, right? But we're often so blocked only by actively neglecting or repressing our mirror neuron activity through our addictive behaviors, our repetitive behaviors. Big mind gets obscured by our repression. And through our conditioned thoughts, thought control, It's not my happiness, it's his. He looks like he's having a good time. He's smiling at me, but that's his happiness. That's my narrow activity. And that's the root of jealousy, competition, suffering, and war. So bare awareness is the cultivation of mirror neurons and the resulting neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity, which just means a joyful sense of intimacy. That's all it means. Joyful sense of intimacy. Like any biological ability, mirror neurons need to be used in order for them to multiply. So a practitioner here is right now doing a 3-week, 3-week retreat at home. And, you know, it's not like she sits zazen all the time, but she comes here and sits sometimes in the morning and meets with me once a week. And for 3 weeks, she's just mostly staying in her house and being quiet, being still, and doing some of her own meditation with some guided meditation and being quiet. Well, one day a week, and I met with her the other day and asked her how it was going, and it's going well for her. Although she feels the deprivation of not having those usual neurons firing in her narrow pathway. So it's well, but it's not well. I mean, if you do a retreat, you'll know what I mean. Most of you have done one already. But ultimately, it's well. It's just that you feel a little cramped. Where is your stimulation? One day a week, she just does loving kindness all day. That's what she does. Loving kindness all day. So if you do metta all day, loving kindness all day, then that really fires up your mirror neurons. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. Because of our mirror neurons, we're able to have empathy for each other. Empathy for each other. Right? That's what empathy is in this brain field physiology terminology, which I never would have read even. If I didn't get into it, I thought, oh, this sounds like something else, something ancient and wonderful. Then I really got into it. But what happens? But we can also have empathy for our own form, for this own little self in here that we put down because we say it's not plastic enough. It's too hard. We want to get away from it. Well, if we want to soften it, we have to have compassion for it. We have to have love for it. It's not denying it. It's petting it. Petting it like your favorite kitty. Like your favorite kitty. What happens when a mirror neuron sparks empathy for its own process? What happens when the mirror neuron's awareness turns to other mirror neurons within itself and the brain becomes aware that it is aware? Self-love and compassion is what happens. It just happens. But it takes practice. Right? Until we can feel like a tunnel of mirrors within ourselves into infinity or something or other. If what is true of a peanut is also true of enlightened minds, then the liberation of our own perception from the limitations of habitual reactions and thought patterns can have an immediate physiological impact on us and everyone around us. Generations forward and backward, without us moving a muscle or saying a word. So last year when I was sitting Brahatsu, you know, we sit Brahatsu at the same time as everybody does all over the world in Zen places. Well, I better qualify that. Japan, Southeast Asia, I don't think they do that You know, everybody decides Buddha got enlightened on a different day, depending on their culture. So we decided, our culture, which comes from Japan and China, says that Buddha got enlightened on December 8th. Although this year we're entering our Rahatsu before December 8th, so we get enlightened afterwards. Anyway, what was I saying? Well, my friend was sitting in Rahatsu in California, where I'm from, when I was sitting in Rahatsu here. And, you know, so there's all kinds of potential for peanut activities going on, right? Mirror neuron activity going on. So my friend, on the fifth day of his Rahatsu, he got a pain here, a real pain, really sharp pain, and it felt like he had a nosebleed. And after the retreat was over, he heard, and he'd been sequestered, so he wasn't taking any phone messages. He wasn't listening to his cell phone. No texting. If you come to a retreat for us, no texting. If you text, you get spanking. Ted will spank you, not me. I don't do corporal punishment. He does. So when the retreat ended, he found out that his father had had a cerebral hemorrhage when he was out walking on that fifth day in the afternoon, just when he had his. His father was still alive, luckily. He visited his father in the hospital, but his father never got better. So all kinds of examples of this. All kinds of examples of this. And we call this synchronicity, but that's a whole other talk. So here I'm going to go back to the 8th century now and read about an encounter between the Empress Wu and Fatsang. Huayan, Buddhist teacher Fatsang. In the 8th century China, Empress Wu, the only woman to ever hold that title and position, asked a Zen master to explain the relationship between the one and the many. To demonstrate, the master devised a hall of mirrors with a single candle hanging from the ceiling in the center of the room. As he and the Empress entered, he lit the candle. An endless web of reflected light crisscrossed, creating an infinite series of images within images, each containing the flame. How lovely, the Empress explained. Fatsang then held up a small crystal ball. All the flames were mirrored with the tiny crystal revealing how the infinitely large was contained within the infinitely small. And the Empress Wu said, "Now I see clearly the relationship between the one and the many." Then, to emphasize further the nature of our interconnectedness with each other, Fatsang pointed out how each mirror not only reflects the one flame in the center, but the reflections within all the other mirrors as well. All these reflections were mutually identical, yet each one existed individually, he explained. Talking about mirror neurons in the 8th century, huh? Mirror neurons firing our brains, but also, through empathy, firing all other brains. You know, we used to take acid in the old days, before you guys were all born. Well, not all of you were born. Some of you did. You know, we talked about contact highs. Does anybody remember that? Contact highs. Yeah, contact highs. People wanted to hang around Suzuki all the time after they saw that they really got a contact high by hanging around him. People always wanted to hang around Katagiri all the time. They really got a contact high hanging around him. Mirror neurons, right? Duh. So, if you can't come to Rahatsu, just come on Sunday, the last day of the Rahatsu, and enjoy the contact high. Or, to sit at home and think about and meditate at the same time we're meditating. Or turn off your TV and look at the blank TV set while we're meditating. Experience the contact high. Mirror neurons, right? So the plasticity of the brain, the self, and all life. Wow. Wow. We're lucky. Donald Trump or nope, Donald Trump, we're lucky. And that's a whole other discussion. So that's what I want to say today. And I'll be glad to take questions or comments or other pieces of recitations of other pieces of research. Because, you know, I really don't know much about science. I am a psychology. I used to have a license as a psychologist. And there is a science part on the psych exam, but I crammed to study that. And then I forgot it all. So, what's on your mind? What would you like to respond to or mention? Yeah.
With the science piece, there's a really awesome book that I learned about several months ago and have recently started reading. It's by a neurosurgeon,
uh-huh,
professor at Stanford. His name is Dr. James Doty.
A neuro what?
Neurosurgeon,
uh-huh.
And book, it's called Into the Magic Shop, and it's all about his perspective as a neurosurgeon on the connection between the brain and the heart, and really his path to mindfulness. And it's fascinating to see how the two are so related. And just to hear it from a neurosurgeon's perspective.
What's his last name?
Doty, D-O-T-Y.
Oh, okay.
It's amazing.
Thank you. I'll have to try that one. Yeah.
I read another good neurobiology book by Michael Gazzaniga. It's titled Tales from Both Sides of the Brain. It's about his experience with split brain patients. People have had the corpus callosum split.
Yeah.
And some of the insights that it gives you on what the self is when the self has been split in two. Really some fascinating.
Good. Thank you. And back there in the other room. Why don't you project?
I can project, that's no problem.
Okay.
Hold on, noisy. I don't talk much about politics or work, but I'm surrounded by it there all the time. And I was walking to the train, and I had this bizarre concept of, you know, I'm actually really, really glad Trump won. Not because I agree with his policies and politics, not because I am all that really fascinated by divisive political stuff at all anyway. I feel like it's a great demonstration in a practical way of how much every single person wants to be right and the comfort they derive from rightness and how stark one's own rightness can be compared to some other person's. And I think that the more starkly that gets demonstrated, there's a higher probability perhaps that more and more people will get confronted with that and sort of snap and say, huh, that's really just as hollow and meaningless and useless as any other differentiation of self and otherness that we experience in our daily life. And that's sort of what happened for me, I think. I recognize on the micro level all the little tiny things that are going to probably come from having such a personal election. But I'm trying to be optimistic in a really metaphysical way about it. And that works enough for me most of the time.
Well, thank you. Good for you. Thank you. Good for you. Yeah.
Yeah, I just, I think that comment and your talk linked together for me in this way. That if the shock from the election has caused me to step back, it's made me aware that I have a choice. And the choice is I can fight back, which means I go right back into the old unproductive habit, or I can see it as a moment for plasticity and imagine a blank piece of paper. I think that's very encouraging.
Good. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
I've walked into a lot of,
can you speak a little louder?
In a lot of rooms of doom and gloom where people are just not talking or communicating. And all it takes is one person to trigger the opposite effect. And just one person is laughter or making a joke, and then everybody else seems to pull into that same type of mode. and get out of whatever they were in at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we can each do that, can't we? Can each do that.
One person.
Yes. Wonderful. That's called spreading the Dharma. But we don't have any idea of Dharma. As soon as you get Dharma in there, you want to... It's spreading the non-Dharma. just being alive and joined to people by just enjoying being. That's all. Plasticity. Yeah, Eileen. Eileen, will you try it? If you can't speak loud, I'll say it to the other people, but see how loud you can speak.
I just wanted to, I'm sorry, it's just kind of make myself be more open to the entire group. I just wanted to make a comment on what you talked about with sensory that gets changed in the brain. Was part of a spiritual psychic development group for actually two different groups at different times for several years, and one of the practices that we would do is called psychometry, and that would be just having touch of an object and then being able to actually, it's just different people got different things, maybe a feeling about with that object of the person who owned the object, or maybe a visual of what that person looked like or what they were doing while they had the object and last had the object or wore the object, or even a photograph and being able to get imagery and feeling from that. So I relate to what you had talked about with some having experience in that group.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. I think so. Yeah, I think many of you had some kind of experience like that, but you tend to think of it as an anomaly, something weird, but it doesn't have to be an anomaly. It doesn't have to be weird if you settle your mind down. It can be kind of ordinary.
We treated it as a muscle.
Pardon?
We treated it like a muscle.
Uh-huh.
So if you have exercising the muscle.
That's right, exercising the muscle. Yeah. Thanks. Maybe time for one more. Yeah.
Good morning. You spoke compassion, and particularly self-compassion.
Yes.
Truly, resonated with me. Ever since the election, in particular, I've been when I speak to a group, or actually even sometimes I look in the mirror and just look deeply at myself. And I'll say, I see you, I accept you as you are, and I love you. And it's for me, the self-compassion piece comes from that phrase. When I say it, when I acknowledge people and I say that to individuals, I feel the softening in my heart and in my mind. And I guess it kind of relates to specificity.
It more than kind of relates. Yeah. That's just what you're doing.
Yeah.
You are softening and opening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't it feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, it's challenging because, you want to... I think we're all kind of raised to automatically think, bad, good, evil.
Yeah.
The good guy or
yeah.
the savior. And, but then, recognizing, well... You can't. Sometimes life isn't that black and white, and in order to cope and thrive, and to actually talk to others that have a different viewpoint, particularly those who, for whatever reason, supported the other side or have their fixed views or hold a fixed view on things, how do you still maintain that love and compassion?
Mm-hmm.
But thank you so much for
the
talk.
Sure. Oh, cool. Wonderful. Okay. Well, there might be time for one more, I see, if anybody has something more. Pamela? Pamela has something. Oh, okay.
You can, if talk a little bit about, you talked about meditation and seeing intimacy and empathy, and also how difficult it is. I've also heard you talk about how beautiful it can be, deep abiding joy, you say, with regard to meditation. I think that there, I've also heard you talk about getting blissed out, and I think that there's a, you know, can you say a little bit about that?
Well, you asked, you had, it seems like there are a few questions in there, but I'll answer the last one about getting blissed out. So if you have a, let's say you have a really good experience meditating, and you're just totally with your breathing, and you're so with your breathing that this can happen, actually, that, you know, time and space kind of fall away, and you're just... you're just in a wonderful state. This does, anybody who meditates has a possibility of experiencing this. But then you it can so easily become an addiction. It's just another addiction. So you want it. You come out of it. It's time to eat. It's time to it's eating time. The bell rings and you're back with your food and so then you want that back. So you try to remember how you created that. What did you do? How were you breathing? What were you saying to yourself? You try to imitate it. Then you create a new narrow neural pathway that's going toward that. And so your meditation becomes there's always a potential to soften up. And not try to get a reward from any neural pathway. And when we do that, then we open to a kind of joy that's not addictive, because you don't get anything. Everything's just here, and you're not getting anything. Tim doesn't get anything from this great joy. He doesn't learn anything, doesn't get anything. It's what T.S. Eliot called, as I was saying to Kathleen this morning, the still point of the turning world. What does Tim get from that? Nothing. Well, it's just great. No thing. Nothing. So that's all I have time to say now. I hope that was helpful. Thank you all. Thank you.